Hello, and welcome to recording number 22 of Gary Gygax's Saga of Old City, an annotated reading. We're going to start here on page 154, paragraph 6. Ross stopped before a hut, indicating that this was headquarters. After some fumbling, he opened the door, while Gord and Geller held up the unconscious Flatchet. A quick scraping of flint sent a shower of sparks onto tinder, and from the tiny flame a candle was lighted. "Bring him in, and you can tell me what kind of deal you've worked out," called Taw. "You bet," said Geller. It was pitch black outside the door. Gord sensed his companion's wink as they dragged their charge into the structure. There were only two rooms, the bigger being first. It was cluttered with a long table, several chairs and stools, and a bench along the right wall. Todd led them through a crooked doorway and started another candle to illuminate the narrow chamber at the rear. Here they carried the seemingly dead Flatchet, only his faint breathing and the reek of stale beer indicating that he was not, in fact, gone from this world. Without ado, they flopped him atop the cot in the room. Gord glanced around quickly, noting a large armoire, a campaign chest, a commode, and a cloak hanging from a peg near the door. "The strain must be getting to him," remarked Taw, looking down at his captain. What? Said Gord. Taw expanded on his remark. "Ever seen Flatchet get so drunk that he passed out on the job? Then again, I've never seen him try anything this big." "That's for sure," nodded Geller. "Getting an army together to kick Palish ass out of Redspan is one hell of a big undertaking, especially when nobody is allowed to know what they're being hired for." Taw appeared thunderstruck at Geller's casual mention of the real purpose of the stranger's mission in Stoink. Gord broke in and spoke reassuringly, getting the conversation back on the right track. "Let's get us signed up and that advance taken care of, okay, Taw?" he suggested. "I'll need all the time I can get to add another 70 men to my gray beggars, and Geller here has his work cut out, too. Shit, we'd like to field 300 for Flatchet, and maybe we can do that if we ever get started." But Taw was not easily distracted from his concerns, so he told you everything the lieutenant asked. "Of course," Gord piped up immediately. "We're in this too, as Flatchet saw when we agreed to join with everything we've got. When he told us what was really going on, we upped the number. Oh man, I'm sending one of my boys to see if he can locate Steel Jack's band." "Steel Jack? Come on, Taw, you must have heard of him. He runs a bunch of brigands out of the Netherwood. By last I heard, he had 300 horse with a warlock to back him up." Taw looked impressed at that. Gathering his resolve, he went to the campaign chest, unlocked it, and took out a ledger volume and a small brass box. Holding these, he beckoned the other two to follow him back into the main room. Gord shut the door on the sleeping Flatchet as he departed. After flipping the book open, Taw got a quill and an inkpot from the brass box. He had each man inscribe his name and his pledge of men in turn. Then, closing the register, he said, "Come back in the morning, and Flatchet will settle the payments you're to get." "Give me the book," Geller demanded. "What for?" "The deal was for here and now. You're not living up to it, so I'm crossing out my name. Call that drunken stewpot in the morning that he's out my boys, and he has you to thank." "Hey, Geller, don't be hasty," chimed in Gord. "Why don't we just cut the number of men we pledged in half and stay in? Nobody can bitch about that, right?" Taw, looking pale, hastily added, "Sure, Geller, don't be in a hurry to lose out on a nice bit of change, and lots more loot soon. Listen to your pal." Break. well, we have a continuation here of this storyline with Gord, and obviously there was, from all this, immediately Gord and Geller both suspected that this Flatchet, who was recruiting for mercenaries, had something going other than what he was saying. And here we have instead, first he talks about the Horn Society, and we learn that they've taken over war fields and, or is it Warhol, but two of the bandit kingdoms on the western edge of the bandit kingdoms by the Horn Society and the Shield Bands. And then we learn that instead he shifts everything, Flatchet does, is in recruitment, so that instead of being angry at the Horn Society, they're now angry at the Tenas, and they're talking about going and the Tenas having invaded Groskopf and another city in the east and the northeast. But now finally it turns out that it's about the Pale and Red Span. So far along the way this story's been progressing, but it also shows this continual theme where Gord, now Geller, and most people who are of like exceptional ability have some level of discernment where they're able to see through plans and disguises and see the real motivations underneath. All the way back from the point where Gord, as a 12-year-old orphan, had left the taken from the workhouse pretending to be sick, back when Clyde the Sharper saw through Gord's disguise and the intent behind it and sold him off to Theobald. Ever since then, there's always been this continuous theme of subtlety. And as this is a book written from the thief's point of view, part of what Gygax saw in the thief was not only burglary and you know, opening traps and opening chests and locks, but was a good deal of the con man, the swindler, you know, and these plans of subtle plans, a lot of subterfuge going on in this book, and the ability to see through that and see what the other people were planning and hiding. And so we have this here where Gord and Geller are pretending, and again, that's another thing, that they're running a con on what they think are other con men. And that is another point that comes up again and again so far in the saga of Old City. So now at the end we have where the true plan, as far as Taw knows, and somehow Geller has detected that, or you know, had the information previously, that the real plan, or perhaps the real plan, is to go after the Palish in Redspan. So you know, we have this developing campaign of these border wars that are going on. Now it isn't the large nations fighting each other, but pecking away at the bandit kingdoms by the Ten, by the Pale, and at like in they mentioned earlier that they consider the Shieldlanders, Nyrond, the Tenas, the Pale, as all their enemies. But they look on the Horn Society more as their allies. And that would go pretty well, because one of the things about the Horn Society, even though they've taken control of two of the bandit kingdoms, they haven't just come in and said, well, now this is Horn Society land. There have these false leaders put in, who are puppets of the Horn Society. And that speaks of a more, you know, a different kind of relationship than direct conquest would have been. So we have all this going on, and very good campaign ideas to add a little mass combat to the game and also bring in things that will take it in different directions. You won't just necessarily be dungeon or wilderness adventure, or even city adventures. Here it now is an idea for you know, a warfare adventure for mercenary companies and regular warfare, and it takes the game into you know, a different direction than has been mentioned so far. So you know, as a DM, you know, you can look here in Stoink, which is a big mercenary recruiting place, you can look to add that as part of the adventuring. that you can have your characters say, well, you know, they could be the regular caravan guards or bandits, but they could also join a mercenary group, like they're suggesting here, and be part of a big raid of a city or just general fighting, and, you know, a different kind of campaign. Now, like that comment by Gord about this Steel Jack, who I assume is a made-up character. Gord's very quick about making things up, off the cuff. Very off the cuff kind of person. Gord is very similar, in, I think, a lot of ways to what Gygax, was and would like to have been. And here he mentions that this group has a warlock with it. So, you know, one of the things it shows is the relative rarity that Gygax is thinking of these, of magic users and clerics at lower levels, whereas thieves and warriors, they're mostly what he's encountered up to this point. And back when he was part of the Beggars Union, it was commented that Theobald in the war had hired warriors and men-at-arms and some clerics and even a magic user or two. So the hierarchy of rarity seems to be that the magic users in this campaign are the rarest to encounter. Now, we have here something that I think it's cast out very minorly, but that Taw, the assistant to that Flatchet, who's hiring these mercenaries, he pulls out a book and an inkstand and a quill pen. And, that is just quite an advancement that here is a ledger book, so a blank book, already bound and ready for writing with a quill pen for just a mercenary group. So that says that, there's this technology then, that there's all the business about making paper, about bookbinding, making ink for the writing, specifically done. I mean, there's different things you could use to write with, but to have it that this is already established enough so that they would have had all these fairly advanced technological items. You know, it's not, you have to look at the Greyhawk campaign and realize that it is not a medieval campaign. It's a fantasy campaign with a lot of parts that are medieval, but a lot of things that don't necessarily have to follow the same technological advancement as the real Earth. The fantasy Earth here, that can have things that are well out of the norm for a medieval campaign. So, we get a lot of what's going on as far as this con game goes. A little description of Flatchet's mercenary group, where he appears to have a big encampment so far of around 600 men, and the plans for the overall campaign, and the way things are politically and strategically in the Bandit Kingdoms, where they're already describing five of the kingdoms have been conquered in one form or the other. So even if we're not looking at something as full-scale as a nation-on-nation war, we are looking at a change, the Bandit Kingdoms vary in size, but they're none of them gigantic. So we are looking at, maybe the start of where the smaller countries are especially with very hostile neighbors, are being gobbled up. And, there is a lot of talk, the idea that there would have been, some kind of war, general war in the campaign from Gygax's work at a later date. All right. I'm going to restart right here. And it's going to be page 156. And it is paragraph 8. Horton Geller argued heatedly for a couple of minutes, and to Taw's distress, Gord began to come around to the one-eyed man's way of thinking. Seeing real trouble looming, Taw broke in just before he thought Gord was about to also demand removal of his own name and pledge of men. "Blatchett said you two were going to be captains." "Lieutenants at first," answered Gord, "but when we offered to bring in two companies, he said we would be captains at 5 luckies per, plus a bounty based on the totals of our pledges, so we could have faith in you guys. Then he kicked in advance to help us recruit." "I haven't got that kind of cash now, fellows, honest. Tomorrow..." "Too late," Geller broke in. "We're out of this." Gord and Geller made to leave. But just then, the second of Flatchett's lieutenants entered with a couple of recruits. With the arrival of his comrade, Taw saw a way out of this fix, and told them to wait just a second. He pulled the other lieutenant, Swutch, into the bedchamber and closed the door. The two new recruits, tough and mean-looking, glared at Gord and his one-eyed companion. The looks they got in return caused the pair to gaze elsewhere, until Taw and Swutch entered the main room a couple of minutes later. Swutch quickly signed up the two cutthroats and hustled them out, barring the door on the inside as they left. "You better be right," Swutch said ominously to Taw, as the pair moved aside the heavy table, grabbed a plank, and heaved. A trap door, cleverly hidden, opened to reveal a cellar below. Taw descended the steep stairway. Swutch motioned for Gord and Geller to follow, and he came last, closing the trap door behind him. Taw's candle shed only a faint illumination, but he soon had another pair of thick yellow tallow candles flaming so that Gord was able to see the place clearly. They were in an earthen cellar, fairly deep, with ledges built along the walls. It was originally a place for storage of roots and the like, now used as a repository for something far more valuable. Somehow Flatchett and his associates had managed to get a great iron trunk into this place. Gord was reminded of Theobald's strongbox, only this chest was at least 10 times that size. Empty it would weigh several hundred pounds, he guessed. Taw stood in front of the chest, shielding what he was doing, but in a moment he had completed his secret manipulations. There was a grating noise as he turned the key, and then he called Swutch to help him with the lid. Pear lifted the slab of metal so that it rested at an angle against the dirt wall behind. Inside were more electrum, silver, and copper coins than Gord had seen in his life. "Let's see," murmured Taw. "Each of you gets 5 luckies, and commons totaling 300 plus. Swutch turned back towards the recruits, just in time to get out a warning to his partner. "Look out!" Gord attacked Swutch even as he spoke, his dagger glinting darkly in the pale light. Geller, meanwhile, sprang forward to engage Taw, who pulled a heavy-bladed knife from his belt the moment his partner shouted the warning. Combat was noisy and protracted, but little if any of the sound would reach any listener above. Gord wounded his opponent several times, taking only a small cut in return. Swutch wasn't nearly as skilled at dagger work as the young thief. Lieutenant feinted a move toward the stair, leaped the other way, and struck out at one of the heavy candles, which went out. Gord understood his desire. In darkness, Gord's skill and acrobatic movements would be negated. The fight would become blind groping, striking at sounds. Swutch made another feint, hoping to drive Gord away so that he could extinguish the other candle. As he reversed himself toward the taper, Gord moved squarely into his path, and Swutch fell back, wounded again by the keen point of Gord's long dirk. "Take it all," Swutch cried. "Kill Taw if you have to, but let me go. I'll never be seen again, honest." But even as the bandit lieutenant begged for his life, he hurled his blade. Gord sidestepped quickly, The dagger, which had been headed for his throat, caught him in the shoulder instead. The gourd momentarily disabled, Swatch lunged for the stairs. He leaped to the fourth step, rushed upward, and strained to heave open the trap door. Two daggers struck him in rapid succession as he did so. The first was Gord's, the second Swatch's own, withdrawn from where it had stuck in Gord's left shoulder. That blow finished the would-be escapee, who slumped lifeless at the top of the stairway. As he turned, Gord saw Geller avoid a knife swipe and then lunge forward to strike Taw a tremendous blow to the temple with the pommel of his dagger. The bandit fell heavily. Geller added a couple of blows with the blades of his weapon for good measure, then turned to Gord when he was satisfied that Taw was finished. "Let me see that wound," Geller said, moving close enough to examine where Swatch's blade had bitten into Gord's shoulder. "You're bleeding heavily, but you'll be all right," he said calmly as he reached into his belt sack for a swatch of cloth. The flow of blood was easily staunched, for the wound was clean and not terribly deep. Gord's padded doublet had taken much of the force away. Geller bandaged the puncture with the sure-handedness and swiftness of one who had done this sort of thing often before. "It'll pain you for a few days, and unless you get a cleric to take care of it, you'll have to get someone to sew it shut. You'll survive." He was grinning as he said that, and Gord smiled broadly in return. Break. All right. Now, here we have another example of how Gygax is taking a descriptive combat, which is really handy for a DM to pick up on that trait to really flesh out, just the what can be a boring, I swing, I roll, I swing, I roll kind of combat, which is, very much, nothing but dice rolling. And instead, add this sense of excitement and adventure to the combat. And here, as a looking at it in the other way, he's taking what is, a combat between characters who, say, have a number of hit points, and telling you how you could describe it that matches the kind of thing that you get in the role-playing. So that in AD&D combat, two characters with hit points, a measurable amount of hit points who are fighting in this kind of knife fight, it would take both of them to take a few thrusts and blows and near misses to drain those away. And then we see Gord's abilities. Gord is only wearing padded armor, but he's a high dexterity character. So in game setting, that would give him an advantage in his armor class. And then he is able to quickly throw his dagger and then withdraw a dagger that's stuck in his shoulder and throw that as well. So we have Gord at this point really getting past mid-level, I'd say. We also have this business where the one character, Swatch, he is a warrior, but he is not as experienced a knife fighter as Gord is. And that could just be taken that he's a lower level character in the game, or Gygax was fooling around with weapon specialization, where the idea would be that, even though Swatch might be familiar with more combat weapons, he wasn't that familiar with knife fighting. We have the example now. Geller seems to have gotten through unscathed in all this. And then because Gord is wounded, we have an example of what in the game would be binding wounds. And even the mention by Geller that you better have a cleric see this or have it sewn up. And earlier on, at the beginning of the book, Gygax had mentioned that there were physicians, so that healing is not just done by clerics. There's also a physician, occupation, so that you can have characters be healed through a physician, but obviously not magical healing, and not at the rate that you would get from a cleric casting a spell and healing a whole bunch at one go. But the old healing was very slow in AD&D. Here we have a statement that it's a shame they never codified a non-magical healer. And that is true. There should have been in the game they should have had non-magical healers. They very early on had the binding of wounds, and that was always a major thing because, either that business of stopping the major damage, and I always used it where it could save people, from zero hit points to one hit point, where they're no longer in danger of being dying, or they could move or be walking wounded. But at the same time, the game never said, well, here are clerics, but they're supposed to be rare. And here, why wouldn't there be non-magical healing done? We also have in the early mention of the game that there are plagues. So there's obviously disease that isn't being taken care of by the clerics. And it's common enough so that when Gord is in the workhouse, they immediately recognize that he has something they call blood pox. And so here is a deadly plague that is not known, that is not stopped by the clerics out of hand. And it is common enough that even just another jailer and that the regular people in the workhouse know what this plague is. And that really says then, well, the rich probably have access to the clerical healing and the powerful, but that the common person is unlikely to. And in the city of Greyhawk, one of the things that was interesting is that, like, say, in the slum quarter, the worst area of the city of Greyhawk, there's no mention of clerical missions. Like, the good deities haven't set up anything to help the unfortunates living in the slum quarter. So, there's good according to the fantasy setting, and then there's good toward what, like a modern interpretation of good would be. So it doesn't look like within the city of Greyhawk, although there are all these different, temples and cathedrals, that none of them, according to Gygax's city of Greyhawk, are out there helping the really, unfortunate and the lowest members of the Greyhawk, city of Greyhawk society. There's, as with all of this, it's interesting to see the action, the combat, and how it comes out. There isn't really much. I'm not quite sure about the size of that iron trunk that would weigh several hundred pounds. That just sounds out of normal to me, but maybe Gygax is more familiar with what the pay chests would have been like, and it just seems awfully heavy for a chest that's supposed to transport coin. And obviously it sounds like there's some kind of trap set to it because Taw is there hiding what he's doing and then takes out the key and opens it. All right. I am going to restart right here. It is page 159, paragraph 3. Both men began quickly separating the coins. Copper went on the dirt floor, silver to one side of the chest, electrum to the other. Eventually, they had the rough stuff roughly divided, and then it was time to load it up. Using the shirts of the two lieutenants, they created makeshift sacks for their luckies, tossing in a few of the silver nobles to complete each load. That was inspired, Gord. Good thing for you, I'm fast on the uptake, Keller said as they bent to the sorting of coins. Then he paused and looked at his companion. What made you think of this? I saw you put the drug in Flashit's ale, but the rest was one of the best planned deceptions I've seen in a long time. All right, I'm stopping right here because we have, in these two paragraphs, we have a couple things. I'm always very interested in the coins, and I believe at the back of the book it said that you'll find a thing about the values of the coinage. But I'm just dealing with it as we go along. And even though I've read all this, it's been a while and I'm not word for word or idea for idea familiar with everything. So here we have again, the old explanation of the value of coinage went platinum was the worth the most, and then gold, and then electrum. And an electrum, a platinum was only worth 10% more than a gold piece, a platinum plate. And it was a gold orb in the city of Greyhawk. And then when you got to an electrum, that was only worth 10% of a gold piece. And then they never gave an equivalent value for silver or copper. And then the next thing down was a bronze Z. Now, a bronze Z, 1,000 bronze Z was one gold piece. So here we go, and they don't have any gold, but we have in this chest copper, silver, and electrum. So what do? They just dump the copper. And then the silver, they only throw in a few of the silver nobles. And again, this is Stoink, but it may be just from Gord's point of view that he's calling it a silver noble, a copper, and an electrum lucky. But that's also being used by the mercenaries, Flatchet and Taw and Swatch, to call it an electrum lucky. So that seems to be like used more, those terms for the coins, in more than one place. And here we are, all the way up in Stoink, fairly distant from the city of Greyhawk, and they're still referring to coins in the same way. They don't even talk about the lower value stuff, but already in Stoink, part of the common usage is talking about iron drabs. And that was the lowest form of currency in the city of Greyhawk. And here it's mentioned in Stoink, and it seems like that entire that basage of coinage, which is by metal type, you know, it's not by the size of the coin or the minting. So far, it's just metal for metal. It's, you know, platinum, gold, electrum, silver, copper, bronze, brass, and iron. So what we get here is, we see that, you know, they're only throwing a few silver nobles in. And although we don't know how much they're worth, that really says that the value of that silver noble is pretty low. It's and there's other indications from previous things, like with the René, there were some finds that were in silver nobles. And none of that seemed to be particularly, you know, valuable. All right. And now the second thing here is they had not said that Flatchet was drugged earlier. Flatchet is trying to recruit Gordon Geller. He's offering them buy them ale. And then suddenly Flatchet gets slurring and passes out. And it's not mentioned that Gord has slipped the drug into Flatchet's ale. And here again, they say out and out that Geller calls it the best planned deception I've seen in a long time. And that goes with this theme of that thievery involves a lot of this, the business of deception. And here we even have slipping Flatchet a Mickey, you know, putting a drug in his drink, which would entail that Gord is carrying that with him just on the chance. So that would have to be, and, you know, it was something that was common, in the early 20th century, the slipping of Mickey. It was common when they would knock out people and then put them on board a ship when they shanghaied sailors. They would put a drug in their drink. So it just says that their Gord is walking around without any plan ahead of time. But he's already keeps with him this drug that will knock out Flatchet. And so this goes on with the theme of deception and discernment that flows throughout the book so far. Geller is able to discern Gord's plans, and Geller is able to disguise that he knows what's going on. And, that drugging, it does, you know, in the is that an evil act? It certainly seems like you wouldn't just be like neutral to do it, but I think they press towards alignment as neutral, and balance neutrality is a big theme later on, you know, within these stories. And I think that a lot of things that are might be evil, Gygax has certainly pushed in this story as a more of a sense of neutrality. And, you know, if you looked at some of these acts, you really look back at the city of Greyhawk as described, and it seems like it is, you know, a pretty evil place. I mean, the poor, their lives are just, you know, like mayflies. They live, they die. In the slum quarter, when somebody dies, they drag the body out to the outside the building and let wild dogs consume it. It's a very, very harsh place. Now, there was a recent review of this, and that was one of the complaints, and that this reviewer is saying, don't read this book, he's so shocked. If you look at the back of the book, the first thing it says is Greyhawk, a beautiful, wondrous city, a cruel city, a harsh, pitiless city. And I mean, Gygax isn't trying to hide that this is not, you know, this is not Wonderland. This isn't Shangri-La. This is a exotic, fantastic, magical city that is also cruel and harsh. And at the beginning, you get a real big dose of how cruel and harsh it is, because they have Gord rising from being the lowliest of the low, as an orphan in the slum quarter, and then rising himself up, you know, by his own skills, to the point where very early on he's made a least master in the Beggars Union, and then he's a highly skilled, well-known, you know, person outside of the Thieves Guild who is performing these cons and thieveries in the High Quarter and the Garden Quarter, you know, for quite a while, and then. You know, for months at a time, and somebody who went, got himself educated in the university district, first with a tutor and then at Gray College. So Gord, and then got private training in, you know, swordsmanship. So Gord has not only these massive, you know, these very, you know, exceptional abilities with intelligence and dexterity, but, and probably wisdom as well, charisma, but that he is also, because of the intelligence and wisdom, he knows to increase, you know, what he knows. So he's always trying to learn. When he was recently with the Rene Atloy, the ones in the caravan, they were these people who, the Rene bargemen, they do a little showmanship, like with trained animals and things, but it is the Rene Atloy who are almost like a circus, going around with tumblers and, you know, they're horse traders, but they're more like a carnival, traveling carnival in a sense. And because of their acrobatic and tumbling and contortionist skills, Gord learned all that from them. So every place Gord is going, he's not only learning about the world, he's learning his naivete, especially around women, which he has shown from an early age, is fading. I thought a little disjointed because he became very harsh right away, but, you know, that is just a character choice. Gord has done several things which I would, even trying to look at it through the eyes of the campaign setting and the AD&D rules, would classify more as evil than neutral. But, you know, the problem with alignments and that is it is really a... you know, you're doing things by whatever standards you have, your own definitions, and some people might put the line of good and neutrality, evil and neutrality, further or lesser, and you know, you come up with your own definitions for general terms like that. So the things, not so much that was evil to put the drug in Fletch's ale that surprises me, it's just that Gord had it on him all this time. You know, it's never mentioned where that he was doing that. But again, like I said, that was that business is Gygax had not mentioned that Flatchett was drugged by Gord, and then he reveals it later, and that is also something that happens, that I'll be reading this, and as I'm commenting on paragraph by paragraph, I notice something, I bring it up, and then a few more paragraphs or another page or two down the road, and Gygax explains that was what he was doing. So there are things that are from Gord's perspective, they're hidden, and then eventually revealed to the reader. It's just that reveal adds something to the telling of the story. All right, I'm going to restart right here on page 159, paragraph 4. While Gord kept working on the loot, he told Geller that the powder was something used by the Rene. Then he explained his thinking. I could tell that Flatchett was lying through his teeth. He isn't very clever, and certainly not smart. Whatever he's doing, he's been set up, I think, and he is in way above his head. Hey, Geller, take a look at this. Geller looked down into the huge iron box. You've hit the bottom, he said. Let's get going. Oh, take another look at the bottom. It's about half a foot too shallow. Geller reached down, put the fingers of one hand on the floor of the iron container, then extended his outside arm down to the floor. Right you are. Let's find the secret panel. With that, the two thieves began a careful and painstaking scrutiny of the great trunk. Gord spotted where access to the hidden space beneath the false bottom could be gained, and called his comrades' attention to it. Both examined the place minutely. Don't screw around with it, Gord. Those tiny scratches are some sort of magical runes, and there's at least one needle trap here, too. See the hole? It's time to take what we've got and clear out. I've got another idea to try before we give up, said Gord. Help me tip this thing so it's bottoms up, and I'll show you something you're going to like. Miller shook his head in doubt and disagreement, but he took hold on the chest and assisted Gord in standing it on its side. Coins spilled out and rolled across the hard-packed earth. Gord tugged the lid shut. The pair levered the big box to rest on its top. A rusty slab of iron covering the underside of the trunk presented itself to view. Now what? Geller asked sarcastically, as he watched Gord draw his dagger. Then he gaped when he saw Gord's dagger point scribing a shallow gash in the metal bottom. What the hell you got there, Gord? I've never seen a blade cut like that before. Gord merely grinned through his clenched teeth as he pressed harder on the weapon. A couple of more strokes and he had made a squarish set of lines about an eighth of an inch deep in the iron. With these to guide his work, the young thief began to make gouging motions with the weapon so that the dagger's blade passed back and forth along the channels from one to another. It was like a normal knife blade cutting oak. Slow work, but certain to succeed. In minutes, the task was done. A square of metal clattered down into the place between false bottom and real one. There was, as predicted, a half-foot space beneath. Geller brought a candle near, and golden light was reflected back in its flickering illumination. All right, now, here we have Gord's dagger, which is this long tooth dagger, and it was something he purchased back in Radagast City. I think it was Radagast City. It was either Lukesh or Radagast City. And thinking about it, I think it's Lukesh. Sorry to jump around like that, but Gord had this magic dagger. He didn't know it was magic. He had gotten it from a very powerful member of the Thieves Guild in the city of Greyhawk. When he was within Rene, the barge folk were attacked on the near Dev after being driven into deep water by a storm, and Gord threw his dagger into this giant sea monster's eye and helped to save the barge. But he lost his dagger. Now, when he described it to this seller of magical weapons, this dwarf, back in Lukesh, I believe, he wanted to get a replacement dagger, and then found out the one he had thrown was probably what was called a long tooth. And that's what Gord bought. But he said that the one he had sounded like one made for demi-humans. And the one he bought was made for humans. Now, this long tooth negates armor that's non-magical. So you can see how, especially for a thief, that's such it's a poignard rather than a smaller dagger, how devastating that would be when he faces anyone from normal plate mail to chain mail to leather armor, padded armor, and this dagger just cuts through it like flesh. So this is this long tooth dagger. Now, Geller, he's in Stoink. Stoink is a big trading city because all these stolen goods and even manufactured goods and slavery, bringing people from all over the Flaness. They're getting goods in from as far away as Ekber and Ket. They're getting wines in from Furiondi and Selene. They're getting cheese in from as far north as the Frusdi. So here, Stoink has all these things. Geller himself is a pretty experienced character. And there he is saying that he's never seen a dagger like this before. And yet this dagger, Gord is able to buy for 6 gold orbs back in Lukesh. And I think there, that even though he puts gold at a very high value, I think there it's a little crazy that such a powerful magical item, that is known as a powerful magical item to the seller, the dwarf blacksmith weapon seller, that he would sell it for only 6 gold pieces. Gygax uses a very different economy, and gold is very valuable, so that a few gold pieces is a real treasure. But at the same time, there's some comparison to what you can get for gold and what you can get this dagger for, and the magical items seem to be very rare, so that low-level and even mid-level characters in this campaign don't seem to possess any. So you're not going to be like a first-level character who runs across, in this campaign, a magical sword or a magical shield or magical armor. It seems like the magic is much rarer than that in the way Gygax is running his Greyhawk setting. So it does surprise me that Geller, and that's why I wanted to mention it right here, it does describe what the dagger can do, the long tooth dagger, but also that Geller says that he had never seen something like that before. All right. I'm going to restart here. It is page 160. And paragraph 6. Using utmost care, the two proceeded to gather up the stuff hidden in the false bottom of the chest. The orbs, there were bright yellow gold, all right. Each bore the horned and crowned death's head of the Hierarchs on its face, with a coiled serpent on the obverse. With these coins were a soft leather bag and a tube of bone. Two thieves tucked the small bag and the coins in with the rest of their booty, and soon after that they had managed to open the tube. Lord, those deviants could have put this here as part of the protections. I've heard of such things, Geller, but cursed or not, we must examine it. Anything to do with the Horn Society is likely to bode ill for us anyway. Break. All right. There's a little more about the Hierarchs, and I had thought that from the description about Flatchet, who is the leader of these mercenaries, who is out gathering people. At first, he talks about the Hierarchs, and then he switches it so that his listeners are agreeing that the Hierarchs and the Horn Society are really more allies, and that they shouldn't be looking at the real enemies like the Palish and the Tenna, and the Nirundis and the Shieldlanders. So obviously from the front, it seemed like the Horn Society would be behind it. And this, again, is one of those things where Gygax has a reveal later on. And it's unsurprising. I don't think it really was hidden from anyone that the Horn Society would be behind it. But what I'm interested in also is that we have a description of the, they're still called gold orbs, but now we have a description of a Horn Society coin. And that also, you know, it leads things up to where, you know, if you have coinage that shows horn society, that might be a danger. You know, it might be that if you're flashing a lot of coin with the horn society markings on it, you might fall under, you know, general interest from horn society minions. People were worried about the horn society. It does say something, though, that those orbs that reveal that they're from the horn society, that may not be the best thing to give your agents. So if you wanted to give people who you're doing things for you in secret, it might not be a good idea to pay them in your own coinage. Maybe pay them in Nirandese, Greyhawk, Furiundi, Palish coins, rather than pay them in the Horn Society. But, you know, it is a little reveal here. And as Gord had said, Flatchet was seemed pretty stupid. Now we have, you know, the idea again here of trapped chests, and you know what, how you can describe when the thieves are searching for traps and disarming traps. That again, it's a more flavor text and description to enhance a game setting. Is that you could come off of this off the cuff like Gygax did, but on the other hand, I think you can also, you know, cut these out and maybe write them down if you're trying to learn that kind of thing, and pull them out like they used to do in box text for modules, just to have them prepared to read off if you're not really, you know, a kind of DM who really pulls stuff off the out of your hat and off the cuff. So here, you know, we also have the idea. We've got this, the tube of bone, and we have the idea then that this is also the part where there can be magical protections. And so if you're doing a chest, and it's a valuable thing, make sure that you think about, maybe not all the time, but having hidden coins and traps, you know, just to add something. I wouldn't do it all the time, because the more you do something, the more common and mundane it becomes, so that the extraordinary is turned down to something less than extraordinary. But it is something to think about and adding to your campaign that you use, you know, occasionally, and just to spice things up a little bit, and where it would fit in logically. All right, I am going to restart. It is page 160. And it is the final paragraph. Without further hesitation, the one-eyed thief unrolled the parchment within the cylinder, while Gord moved beside him, so as to be able to read it too. What was there was nothing magical at all, nor was it a map. It was simply a set of instructions written clearly in common. After scanning it quickly, Gord replaced it in the tube and tucked that into his belt. The two men exchanged a few quick words about what they would do next, when then turned the iron chest back upright. Gord picked up both of the shirt sacks stuffed with coins and went upstairs. Geller followed him a couple of minutes later, dragging the body of Swetch with him. He took it into Flatchet's bedroom, dropping it near the still comatose body of the bandit captain. During this time, Gord had been piling straw from the floor of the bedchamber around the base of the dry wooden walls of the hut. As Geller returned from the cellar with Taw's body, Gord was applying a candle flame to several spots along the mound of straw. Then Gord and Geller picked up their loot and let themselves out, closing the door on the flames that were beginning to lick at the walls. They scooped up the registry volume and hastened outside. A faint whitening of the horizon told them that dawn would come soon. They were entering the tower gate of Stoink when it did. Break. Now, this is the end of the chapter. I wanted to mention that on page 61 at the top, there's a Clyde Caldwell illustration of an unrolled scroll with some very strange-looking a writing across it, which is purported to be the common tongue in written form. Then the second thing that really strikes me is, again, the question of Gord's actions. Now, burning the corpses of Taw and Swetch are one thing, but they are also burning Flatchet alive, who is comatose. You know, you would think that in a land where they describe the mercy stroke for severely wounded comrades and, you know, even for enemies, that they could at least have given, you know, Flatchet a mercy stroke instead of leaving him in bed in a burning hut. So I really find, you know, it is really hard to see a lot of what Gord does here and there as a real neutral. And that does seem to be an evil action, but again, that's just my own morality defining what evil is. But in that case, you kind of just throw out the alignment system altogether. I'm pretty sure there are descriptions of evil actions along the alignment system, and I'd think burning Flatchet alive would be one of them. So, you know, there's that, and that's a question about alignments and Gord and such, and it's always something to think about if you're using alignments within, you know, within the game. Gord certainly is immoral, and, you know, when I was saying how Gord had been naive earlier, he finally decided that there was this Renee girl he had really liked named Adaz, and really she had done nothing against him. And he set her up in this where he encouraged her in a way and got her drunk, and she tries to steal and is almost caught. And, you know, that was in Radagast City, I believe. And, you know, it really struck me that was really terrible thing to do. I mean, they're saying, like, thievery, you can get your hands cut off or what might happen to Adaz. And it really struck me that was, again, he didn't have to do it that way. It just struck me as a pretty evil act beyond neutrality. And again, I think, you know, it is, Gygax is one of the ones who was there, approved the alignment structures, and he has given Gord an alignment, and yet I really can't see him as a true neutral. These actions, I just think they add up to a relatively evil, well, not even related, to evil actions. Now, here at the end of this chapter, we've got several things. We've got the reveal about the Horn Society and the appearance of the scroll. But the only other thing that really is game-related is the mention of Towergate of Stoink. And Towergate is, I believe, the entrance to, if you're coming from Haldroon, this is a suburb of Stoink. And Haldroon is where mercenaries, bandits, humanoid tribes, demi-humans, that's where the latest action has all been occurring in Haldroon. And so Towergate is the gate into Stoink. Now, Stoink is a walled city. All right, it used to be a fortification, set up for Nyrond or the Great Kingdom, and it used to be a fortification, and it was slowly had independence and then became a bandit kingdom within the last 200 years, and so it became a much more low cut. But the original city was a walled fortress. And a fortification, and then a walled city. Now, there are two areas called suburbs. One is Haldroon, and one is Rat's Wharfs. Now, all the action here has been Haldroon, and I believe that Towergate is your entrance from outside the city, from Haldroon area, and into Stoink proper. All right, well, that is the end of this chapter, chapter 16. And it's just about 7 o'clock. I want to remind everyone that they can, you can find all the archives up on the Cannon Fire website, so everything's there for you to review, and that if you're listening to this from the website, that over on the Cannon Fire Discord, We also have the Greyhawk Fiction text channel. So if you want to comment, come and listen. You can comment and be recorded, or you can write in comments on the Greyhawk Fiction, and I'll bring them up, and we'll add them to what's being asked and talked about here. And, you know, so that can go. It doesn't get recorded on its own. And that Chris, who's the co-host, and anyone else can add, you know, pictures and text onto the Greyhawk Fiction text channel in Discord. And so that, you know, it supplements a lot of that what we're talking about, especially when we have maps and pictures. And normally Chris would probably put up a picture of that Clyde Caldwell scroll. Well, I'm going to, at 7:01 here, it is July 1st, 2021. I'm going to say good night, and that is going to be it for this recording. Should be a recording tomorrow, but this weekend is a holiday weekend, and I'll have to see what happens.